Welcome back to Open Mind. I'm Keith Barry, and today we're diving into the mind of David Gilna. David has an incredibly rare story. At just 18 years of age, he was struck by lightning. Now, what are the odds of being struck by lightning? Well, give or take, around 1 in 1 million. This event not only changed his life drastically, but ended up being the inspiration behind his now career as an award-winning playwright, producer and performer. David, you're very welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us back, Keith.
Now, we've met before a long time ago on my TV show Brain Hacker, and that was on TV3 then, which is of course now Virgin Media. So I know your story, but for the people out there who perhaps haven't heard your story, let's go all the way back to your 18 and you're struck by lightning. I mean, that's a very unique thing to happen to somebody. So tell us how that happened to you.
Yeah, because I can sit with it because I've told the story about it, and I can, you know, I've lived with it. So like everybody who left this country before me, whether on a J1 visa or going off to Australia or leaving home, I was 18. I was studying in theatre studies in the People's Republic of Clochadulach in Coolock. And we decided as a group that we're all going to go to Boston.
Okay.
Little did I know that everybody in Boston was related to everybody in North County Dublin. But we went to Boston, South Boston, and I got a job working on a building site. Like most of us, some of them got a job in the bar. And it was a great place, a great atmosphere. I remember renting our first apartment for the first time on P Street. We were living in Southie with a group of 10 of us. And it was July 2nd, 2004. And I was working on L Street in Southie across the road from a diner. And I remember using the payphone that day. And the gaffer was going to have a barbecue party for July the 4th. So okay, we could all finish work early. And I was working on a few studs. And there was a ladder at the end of the balcony. And we're on the third floor. And the ladder began to move. And as I walked through the floor, there was kids playing next door in a pool, the innocence of you. And I was worried that the ladder was going to fall over. And as I went to grab the ladder, that's when the lightning struck. A ball from the blue is a term when lightning strikes on a sunny day. The lightning hit the ladder. My hand was on the ladder. It erted, came across my body, erted out of my left foot, blew the sole off my left foot and sent me flying back about 4 or 6 feet backwards. And then I landed on the floor and my heart stopped. And then I woke up with the screaming and the crying from the children next door. And then two of the lads were working on the house up the road. And I could just hear the loud thundering work boots of the foremen coming up the stairs. And then I kind of was trying to picture what happened. I didn't feel any pain when I was struck by lightning. But when I woke up, I could smell my own flesh was burning. That's something that's kind of buried into my subconscious. So I had scars in certain parts or lacerations of my body with the heat. And we didn't know really what to do. One of the lads panicked, lit me a cigarette. I don't smoke. One of them went to the liquor store across the road. But they got me into a car. They carried me down the stairs. And we
You couldn't walk.
I couldn't walk. So they didn't know at the time. So someone gave me cigarettes. Someone went in to get me alcohol.
Did they know you were hit by lightning?
They heard the bang. The kids heard the scream. I was bleeding. I had lacerations throughout my body. So they were trying to figure out, was this a bang? Did I get hit off something on site? But I wasn't using any power tools at the time. So they picked me up, brought me into a car. And as we were going to the Boston Medical Center, it's when I realized that time was running out in my life. I could sense it. I could feel it. I could feel this coldness come from the top of my brain down my body. And I just said to my best friend, Stephen Russell at the time, I said, look, if I'm to die now, man, I said, please don't ring my parents. Ring my godparents in Florida or my auntie uncle in Canada. And I just told, I've never told any of my friends or I've never, as a young fella from Swords, I never said the words, I love you. So I just said, Stephen, I love you, man. Tell my family I love them. And I said, thank you. But don't ring them until, you know, it's 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning. And then I closed my eyes and my heart flatlined for the second time. And then I was just in this complete room of darkness, room of silence, trying to figure out where I was, what was going on and what was happening. And then I remember taking my first breath back, I would say, into a vessel that I didn't feel was my own. And I was in the ICU ward. There was all these nurses and doctors and people and beeps and noises. And I couldn't really feel from the neck down at that particular point in my life. Just trying to figure out what had happened, where I went. and what was I going through? Or was I high on drugs? I just, there was a lot going on there. But that was the kind of, it happened that fast to being in the ICU, to realizing, will I walk again? What's ever to happen to me? Where I am? How serious is this? And then we took it from there. And so Boston and South Boston in particular will always play a huge part of my life.
But let's rewind for a second.
Yeah.
Just before we go on to the lightning, like, was it a sunny day?
So beautiful sunny day. That's when the expression comes, ball from the blue is when lightning strikes on a sunny day. So
that's and does that happen, like, given your experience with this now, have you found that, like, does that happen often, lightning out of the blue?
Yeah, it does happen quite a lot when people hear a loud bang on a sunny day. Well, we're in Boston, so, you know, it's a different story. You wouldn't hear much lightning. But anyone who hears lightning or is in the pool, or they always think of me, you know, lightning can hit you. I know someone who got hit by lightning, you know, stop playing golf, get out of the pool.
Yeah, you hear all
these,
that.
Yeah, get underneath a tree. But if it's going to hit you, it's going to hit you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Lightning always knows where it's going to hit. You know what I mean? There's an entrance and an exit point. And if you're in the middle of that, well then, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you can talk about it in a lighthearted way now. So how long did you spend in hospital?
Sure. The first player out was called Five Nights because it was like literally five nights in the ICU. But I would say it's 10 years of my life. 2.5 years really of recovery.
Okay.
Mentally and physically to movement. I have sensations in my body where I can't feel. So like hot and cold.
Okay.
So this is nerve damage.
Yeah.
And then they were frightened that your balance is in the soles of your feet and your hearing. So I completely, my left foot was completely ripped apart.
Right.
So to get balance back, to get sense of depth back was really important. To get physical strength back, to be able to move. Rehab was huge. I went down to rehab in Florida, which was the lightning capital of America, which is kind of irony of that one. My insurance company, this is a funny one actually, and didn't they send me flowers when I was in the ICU?
Did they actually?
Yeah, three words, get well soon, because I was costing an absolute fortune. At that time, there was they didn't have a stipulation of being struck by lightning.
Yeah.
So my insurance was like over $1 million anyway. But when your insurance company sends you flowers with three words, it means they want you dead. It's as simple as that. You know, with America and insurance. So.
Oh, yeah, I've been in hospital in America. I know how much it costs.
Yeah, so struck by lightning in Florida. I did my rehab in West Palm Beach. There was a lot of athletes like golfers, NFL players, that kind of, to build the strength, the balance, doing a lot of balances and exercises, amazing doctors and people to get me right. So every day it's like a live open workbook that everyone's who got struck by lightning goes into this, and doctors can relate to different patients having different symptoms. Because I had my heart stopped three times. I was pronounced dead. So my heart did actually stop. I was pronounced dead and it began to beat again. And it's all got to do with energy, wavelengths, patterns. They told me if I was struck on the left hand, the heart would adjust.
All right,
it was just the fact that it went through the right hand and went across and down. But if it was the left, they said that was it. So there were all these things that kind of like little moments, little graces, that kind of why I'm still here.
Tell me, I'm always intrigued in this. So I've investigated near-death experiences. We've spoken about it before, but I'm just intrigued. In those moments that you were pronounced dead, did you see a light? Did you feel anything? Was it darkness? Was it blackness? Like, well, what was your experience of that near-death experience, or death experience?
I'm glad because we can have this, because it was over in the play. I talk about it like it happened.
So just rewind for a second. When you say in the play, like, just so we're clear, David is a playwright, and I don't know if that came out of this.
Yeah, so the story tells. So in the play, Above from the Blue, this was my real truth. And my heart stopped three times over a period, but I shortened it for the storytelling on the stage. But what was most important for me was on the third time my heart stopped and I was pronounced dead, I wasn't frightened to die.
Okay.
I had stopped the fight in me to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
So if this was my moment to die, I wasn't praying or asking someone to save me. I went, okay,
here we go.
I've made peace with myself.
Yeah.
And when I made peace with myself, I didn't make a deal with the maker. I was gone into a place where it was just like a wave of energy. And I didn't know where I was going to wake up, how I was going to wake up, what was going to happen. But I can never forget the moment that I inhaled my first. That's something that stays with me, that's imprinted on me.
And has that changed your belief system now? Like, what is it? Like, do you mind me asking, what is your belief in life after death? Or is there a life? Or are you
religious? I'm very spiritual. So, like, my mother was born a Catholic, raised a Catholic. She's very staunch, goes to the prayer groups, the women power prayer. My auntie's a healer, so I grew up with crystals. I grew up with her healing hands. My auntie is crazy and I love her, but when she puts her hand on you and it's like an iron on you, and when she can for some reason take people's illness, she doesn't charge for it, she just has this healing energy. Some people have this warm, when you get a warm hug off somebody, as is it a wave, is it energy? Some people naturally have it, some people are con artists. But my auntie gave me this great balance about the power of the mind, that if I could think about wiggling my toe, if I could think about moving my second toe, if I could concentrate on blocking all these people and noise around me and focus on that energy. And my mother's mantra is that if I have every prayer group in the 32 counties of Ireland pray for you, is that a positive or a negative for the mindset? So I took both of those things. Yeah. So I'm quite spiritual. I love lighting candles for people. I'm a whore for lighting candles. I love it. I love letting people know that if you're not spiritual or religious, so I'm spiritual. I pray. I believe in spirits. I believe in angels. I believe in guides. Do I know what's next? No. But I do, as life is made up of waves and energy. And I can't, I know I've left this place, so I feel like I walk differently, but I can't sit and pretend. If I wanted to make money, I could pretend that, yes, I've seen the maker and all these people. And like, a lot of churches in America have asked me to come over and said, hey,
okay, yeah, you know, yeah.
And I was thinking, I might do to get that house. But no, the idea is for me is I left this place. I did feel something. I did feel an energy. And I don't know what that energy was, but I did feel somewhere. And I did leave this place. And I did see myself in the ICU looking back. In what way or what form? I just saw everything.
So you did. You did have that kind of...
I had that physical...
Out of body kind of experience.
And then what happened was, it could be...
I have something funny to say about that, no, in a good way, in a moment.
I'd like this because it could be the drugs. Here's the second thing I want to say. People tell me stories when I was in and out of sleep or in a coma, and music and different things. And then when I woke up, my mind was tracing to try and figure out who came to see me, who said what. Yeah. Was this a dream? Did I say this? So that's where the writing came in to kind of place everything. So you're in this intensified drama that's your own life. And what is real? What is fake? What is coming from a tube? Or what is what you really felt? So, but I was pronounced dead and my heart did beat again.
It's interesting. There is a through line for sure in people who have had near-death experiences. And the one through line is that the majority of people actually have that kind of out-of-body experience where it looks like or feels like they're floating above their bed looking back down.
Looking back down, yeah.
And they're seeing themselves and the people who are there in that moment in time. So that is a through line, right? Because I've investigated this at length. So with that being said, because I knew that, look, I've spoken about this on the podcast before and I'm comfortable with speaking about it. My dad passed January 25th this year. And but he wasn't religious. It wasn't spiritual, like right up to the end, right? Just wasn't, it wasn't his thing. Yeah. And he was ready to go and he was at peace with going. But so it was me, my mum and my sister were there. And my uncle was there as well when he was passing. And we knew he'd passed. And I don't know why I did it, but because of my, he had a real dark sense of humor, just so people don't think that I'm insensitive when I did this. But when he was pronounced dead, I was thinking, Jesus, just in case this near, and I'm a skeptic, of course, but just in case this near-death experience stuff is real, I looked up towards the seal and I just went, see ya, Dad! And I gave him a big wave. Just in case he was up there looking back down.
Yeah, no.
I just wanted to give him one last laugh on the
I
way.
Like that. No, I think, no, that's beautiful. I tell you what's beautiful about that is a neighbour of mine, her family won't mention her name. Her name was Angeline Grant and she was dying recently and I was walking, going past my walk. She called me over and an incredible woman and she just said to me, I'm dying, David. I haven't got long to live. Tell your parents to call up. They're great people. I had a great relationship with them, David. Keep on going. And her son was over from Australia and he missed the bins. She rang Panda to get the bin collection to come back. And I just said, thank you, Angeline, for being a great neighbour. And I talked to her son, James. She died 2 weeks later. But I met this woman who I didn't know she was that ill, who just said to me, she didn't talk about the afterlife, didn't talk about just this moment of, I won't be here in 2 weeks, David. Keep on going. And then ringing Panda to get the...
Yeah, get the bins.
There was just that realism of life and death right there. And I watched her walk up the driveway. And I said to myself, how could I honour Angeline? And if you were to look up the meaning of a good neighbour, Angeline always gave people time. And your story about your father and being the cynic and saving goodbye, he would have laughed at that, if you don't mind me saying it.
Yeah.
That was a very beautiful reflection of your own father's belief system, and you held that to account. And that's all you can do with people. And that's all I could do with Angeline, not talking about what she believed in or not believed in. She just told me she knew she was going to be here in 2 weeks, and I had a feeling she made peace with that in some way.
So tell me, were you a playwright before?
No, I was a bad actor.
Were you acting in?
Oh my God.
Let us know so we can look it up.
Yeah, any really bad children's show on television, pantomimes, you name it, I'd done it all. I was with Jill Doyle and Eamon Farrell. Actually, this we're in, right, the studio we're in right now, was on Diggs Lane. Used to be where Jill and Eamon had their first stage school. It's where the
Jill Doyle and Eamon Farrell.
Okay. They owned the National Performing Arts School. Yep. Eamon's brother is Colin Farrell. So we were all that.
Oh, I know Eamon. Yeah,
We were all that collect. They were agents. We got loads of gigs and stuff like that. I started to get work when I was like 13, 14, 15, 16. And I was like, oh, I could do this as a career. And then I said, let's go to Clash the Doolig to study theatre studies. And so writing, never wrote a day in my life, was really bad at it. I couldn't really focus in school, but acting or the class clown or making people laugh. I loved how to make people laugh, the energy, that switch. I'm into movement, a stillness, and making people laugh. And when I got struck by lightning and doing rehab, this doctor said, I want you to write down everything that you're experiencing. Write down this journey. Because I, for a guy, I can't stop talking. And then my brain would say, David, stop talking and listen. And my brain had this conversation all the time with myself. And then I began to write because I couldn't communicate. And from the moment I was struck by lightning, I haven't stopped writing. I write every day, whether it makes sense, whether it's just doodles. And that's how all of these notes came together in the collective as a really bad play at Electric Picnic in 2008 in the circus tent with Fawcett's. And from then it's kind of grown and you become better and you understand why you're writing and what stories you want to tell and why stories are so important. So I never wrote a day in my life until I was struck by lightning.
And when you were in the early days of writing and you were a playwright, did you have a day job then here as well?
Oh yeah, I worked actually, would you believe? Shout out to all the people. I Know Your Secrets. I used to work at a place called Reynard's.
I know Reynard's very well. Yeah. Jeez, you probably know some of my secrets from Reynard's.
Yeah, see the connections.
I didn't realise you worked in there. I probably came across you a couple of times.
Started there as a young fella, then went to the bar, and then a guy called Alan Clancy took me back to Swords when the Rise Cafe Bar opened up. And then a guy called Paul Fitzpatrick took me from Alan when I used to put events for the Morgan and the Beacon until they went off to LA. So I was involved in hospitality. And then I looked at hospitality and the entertainment is an industry side by side. And the more money I could get off private investors to put on shows, to pay actors, because you have this dream of had 15 actors, we're going to sell out the Olympia. And then Peter Sheridan came to see a play of mine and he said, David, get rid of the other 10 actors because you won't make any money. Maybe keep it to 3 actors and start there, or maybe start at one man play. So I worked in hospitality until eventually one day that this kind of creative field took off for me.
And when was that day? Like roughly what year were we in now?
Roughly I'll tell you where it took off for to me was when I was in London. I was running bars in Waterloo and then I got to go to the West End. And I think that to me was very important because every actor wants to be there. And then when I got there, I realized it was just a job. It was a really huge eye opener for me that every day I'd walk from the pub. I lived above the pub in Waterloo, the King's Arms. I'd walk over the bridge. I'd go to Leicester Square Theatre and I was performing every day, 2 shows in the matinee. And it was amazing. It was a great play. Very proud to be involved in it. But it was just a gig.
Yeah.
And it was this realization of, wow, okay, it's just a gig, it's just a show. You're chasing something your whole life to get, if I get there, if I get this gig, if I do that. But sometimes when that happened to me, that's when I was doing it full time. I wasn't working the bars anymore. It was,
what year was that?
That was roughly in 2013.
Yeah, okay, so give or take 12 years ago, you jumped into it full time. And when was the first time you went on tour yourself with one of your own plays? Like a full kind of tour?
Full on tour. Well, if you want to, there's a good story I'll tell you. 2014, I came back to Ireland and I was living in London and I had witnessed one of the young lads I gave a job to. He was 19. There was 4 pubs. There was the King's Arms. There was Jack's. There was the Young Vic, the Windmill Taverns. It was like 4 pubs in the centre of Waterloo. I used to always give a lot of Irish actors jobs or Irish artists jobs or young English Irish jobs. And this kid I gave a job to, it was the last night of my play and he's like, you know, I want to be like you and you worked in this bar and you're acting in the West End. And my family came over for the last gig. We were out drinking in the Windmill Taverns there and I said goodbye to him and I was just as I was walking down the laneway, to Rappel Street. He crossed the road to go to the Pit Bar, which was underneath the old Vic. It was a nightclub, or an extended bar, should I say. He got hit by a car and he died. And it's the noise, the voices, you know, dealing with that. And the next day we had one more show left and the producer said to me, you don't have to do this. We'll get a stand-in. And I said, no, because he was coming to that show that day. And I'll never forget sitting in the auditorium and it sold out and it was just one seat and all the bar staff and all the crew were there. So I really had a huge, he was so young and he was gone. So I kind of sat with myself, locked myself away. I wrote this play, didn't think much of it, gave it to an actor in Dublin and it landed on a man called Carol Shields' desk in Dublin. And he rang me up and I met him in a place called Lanigan's on Eden Quay. And he kind of gave me a hug because I was a very dark play, I would say, about the industry and what I seen and what I witnessed, as well as the honest humour.
Yeah.
Met Michael Scott, the director, and we put the play on. And then from that moment, Michael Scott and Carol and Laura and people got behind the play and we toured the play for about a year. Play got translated across Europe and France and in Rome. And that's when I realised when the play started to translate to different languages that maybe I had something or I was going somewhere. That
must have been exciting to have your work acted by other actors in different countries, different languages.
You like cymbals. In the theatre they booked in Rome, it was called Teatro Electro and had a little lightning cymbal. And there was a guy, an actor called Alberto, who lived in Dublin. He brought it over and they were speaking in Italian. And for some reason, they said the word battered sausage instead of saying in it. So I was sitting there with my cousins and they were like, Italian. And they were like, battered sausage. So my bedsit window is Il Sopra, Il Stanza, Il Pub, I think is the translation.
Okay.
Sorry for I butchered that Italian, yeah, for any Italians listening out there. But it was amazing because I was sitting in all these venues in different languages, in Spanish and French and Italian, listening to my work. And I wasn't really looking at the actors. I was just looking at the... So from a very dark moment in my life came the real... That was the real first sense of touring Ireland and going to all these different beautiful venues. That was a real beautiful moment, but a moment that's kind of blurry for me because it all happened through connection to great people to kind of help me to where I needed to be and to connect with people because there was an honesty to it. I was talking about the highs and lows and the amazing highs we get in this business, the entertainment business or show business or hospitality, and then the absolute lows. And I wanted to find a real balance. And I think I was in such a dark place, just as sitting with the writing and writing, bleeding on those pages, I think people could really connect. Because I
was about to ask, like, you've obviously been through a lot of trauma. So I suppose my question is, was the writing a form of therapy or did you have other ways to cope?
Writing was a huge form of therapy for me. I didn't even...
The reason I asked that though is I want to pause on that for a moment because there's going to be people out there listening to this who are struggling right now with their mental health, that even if they might not be playwrights, they might not be writers, they might not be in the entertainment world. And truth be told, a lot of people say to me, they come to me and say, oh, Keith, I've tried everything with my mental health. I've tried every pill, every potion. I've tried every therapist. And I always say to people, you've never tried everything. And for me, just to pick up on the reason I asked you that is, maybe people out there should just try like deep writing maybe. Or I don't know what way you would describe it. Do you know what I mean? How did it help you and how did you...
It's huge because you're walking around day in, day life and you have all these ideas. I don't know how your brain pattern works or how you process information. You sit that with a pen and paper. It has to be the process. So pen and paper, old school. Then you get your phone and then you can get your laptop. So you have three devices, right? Yeah. So you could have notes, or if you don't like to write, it's a voice note, right? Yeah. But I want you to mark those moments. Mm-hmm. So it's a Monday. Write the date down. Write the idea, what you're going through, what you're feeling, what you'd like to reach. This is just for you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, this beautiful line or something someone funny says hits you and you go, oh, this is good.
Yeah.
I might go down to the coffee shop or to the sports club or to the local pub, wherever you communicate with people. Try that line to a few people. Speak about it. Connect to the human touch. And if you get feedback from that, people, that's quite funny or that's quite deep. Mm. I really connected with that. Now you've connected a piece of words. If you've written down on the page, it's connected to another human being that they got something from that. So your work has been valued by the process of just putting it out there.
Yeah.
And it all started with the pen and paper, the notes, the voice note. So start that process every day for you. Then when you think this is a really good line in a poem or a good line for a TV script or a good name or something that was just funny, tell people it, get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And then that this beautiful relationship with your words, you and the blank page and the healing process, or just for you and nobody else to read that.
Yeah.
That's very powerful. And it's this beautiful relationship that will be with you for the rest of your life, with you, your thoughts, and how you create those words, what device, or you like the typewriter or the tap of a keyboard, whatever it is. It's a beautiful way for you to sit with it and grow with it and to share your work with the world, whether it should be staged professionally or staged in the local pub or just meeting a friend for a walk. Write it down, edit it, because the key to any writer is to edit it, to get it before you deliver it.
Wow. And then I suppose from those traumatic moments comes this professional writing, this writing that you can take on tour. So I know you've toured the States well. So you went back to the States.
That was a game changer for me.
And when was that?
So big idea. I'm going to sell up everything and I'm moving to America in March 2020.
Okay, yay! It's not that long ago.
Yeah, March 2020, before the pandemic, St. Patrick's Day was going over.
Yeah, I can see where this is going.
Yeah, we were shooting a pilot for Frank Allen. It was called Codgers in Dublin. So I was shooting a pilot. It was for Channel 4. And then I'm going to go to America. And then COVID hit, the last day of film, boom, COVID hit. You can go to America, David, but you might not be able to leave America. How long can you stay in America? Oh, this
all
is great.
Yeah.
I think I'll take the decision to say I won't go to America before they close down the borders. Yeah. Didn't go. So every day for 2 years of my life, I made a promise to someone I'll get back to before they passed away. And this was just between me and him. It was my brother-in-law while he was alive. And every day for 2 years, I rang every venue. I changed flights. It's the first time I was funded by Cultural Ireland. I've been declined my whole life and I finally got in and I wasn't giving up. And I rang and I rang and I rang. And I started building relationships with different Irish art centres through America. On a January 15th, 2022, I went on the plane. I landed in New York City. They took me to Fitzpatrick's Hotel. I left the hotel, lit a candle in St. Patrick's Church, went back. I met the guy who I'd been working with for the last 2 years, who I'd never seen, Mick Malamphy of Origin Theatre. And we had a few pints. We got pissed around New York, singing the L Triangle in Times Square like a bunch of idiots, drunken. I love Brendan Behan, to be honest with you, and I always do a throwback of Behan in my plays. And a guy called Malachy McCourt and John McDonough have a radio station, WBAI, every Sunday, Radio na hÉireann, and they were really championing me. And then the next day, I got to deliver my play to sold out, which I couldn't believe. Everyone was wearing masks. I came down the elevator with the stage manager, and she's like, now, like, go. Real New Yorker. Mm. And I walked out on stage, and I just took off my jacket. I'll never forget, I threw my jacket off and I just delivered this play, A Ball from the Blue, which I've been working on for years. It was my story about being struck by lightning, my journey. And then the play had finished and it was all these amazing Irish actors in the audience and people, and this amazing Jewish woman came up to me and she's like, you got great chutzpah. And I said, what does that mean? And she says, you've got balls, kid, because if you were bad tonight, you wouldn't have a career tomorrow. So when I went back, we went drinking all night with all the different producers and Google alerts were popping up on my phone, reviews from everybody. And I went, oh, for some reason, I didn't think I was being reviewed. For some reason, I didn't think I was on the spotlight. For some reason, I just talked. And I'd never performed this play in front of anybody.
Right.
I was performing with a friend of mine, Frank Allen. He's an amazing playwright and historian and hands around Moore Street, in his kitchen in Drimma.
Mm.
It's the only place I'd ever performed it.
I can relate to that. Like Paul Golden was a good mentor of mine. So Paul Golden was Ireland's original hypnotist. And he was very famous back in the day. And he just said, kid, you just got to have chutzpah. That's it. Chutzpah. And it comes back
and
to
now you're getting back. Yeah.
But again, there's something to be said for that. People listening out there, don't sit in your dreams. Just go do it. Don't wait. Go do it. You know, just get up. If you have an idea, go do it. And don't hold back. And yeah, you'll fail. You'll fall flat in your face. Like, I've failed badly loads of times. And you just go again. Get up and go again. So New York, you did that.
And then what happened was, it was the next date, the next person. Mm. In New York, they meet you and they say, hey, you should meet this person. What can I do for you? They don't waste time, which I love them.
Yeah.
They can be very aggressive and to the point, but they don't waste time.
Yeah, yeah.
I like you. I think I can make money off you. I want to introduce you to this person. He might not like you. And that's what I felt with America. So I was going from New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Kansas. There's a gig already in Los Angeles. Want to go? Yep, I'll go to Los Angeles. Oh, Sunset Strip. I just went with a bag and a box.
Yeah.
And I built up all these connections and started going from A to B to C to D.
Hard that though.
It was the craziest experiences. Like Philadelphia, at the Irish Arts Centre, big up Philadelphia. I was doing this play and I was talking about my mother's family and from Mayo and Swinford. And this guy put up his hand and he says, I left Swinford when I was 16 and he was in his 90s. I know your great uncle, Tony Campbell. And I was just like, I'm in Philadelphia on my own, torn all over Ireland in a bag of the box. And there, and then there's this crazy man with long grey hair who owns a few pubs. He comes from Beaumont, Fergie, if anyone's been in Philadelphia, been in Fergie's bar. And then Dick Massey reached out to me. He used to be in the Commitments. Dick is actually, he's in tour managing. He reached out to me because I was in Philadelphia. So all these people, and it was just, go with the flow, David.
But did you find it a trudge? Like, what were you doing? Were you trying to sell?
Sell small theatres. And the one thing I got battered was I didn't have any merch. They were okay. Like, you have nothing to sell. We want to buy something. So I was like, oh, huge. After each show, what they would do is I'd meet everybody. It's like the Daniel O'Donnell. I love people. I can only become a storyteller or a playwright if people tell me their stories and I listen. So I'd drink with everybody every night, give everybody time who came to see me because I wanted to. This wasn't, it was building this relationship. And it just, let's come back again. And I started building this. There was a place called Unbail Booked in the Bronx where the original Jim Sheridan, Vincent O'Neill, all these great Irish actors came together and started putting on shows. And I got to come back and pay homage to these amazing little spaces where they went to.
What kind of size would that place be in?
Oh, so Unbail Booked was like from 50 people. Philadelphia was 750 people. The Greek Cultural Center was 300.
You're playing in a 50-seater in the Bronx. You're selling tickets. I'm interested. Where were you staying? You're playing to 50 people. Because I know the overheads and everything else. You were coming out with like a couple of hundred quid there, even. Where are you staying when you're in the Bronx?
This is a mad story. So thanks to John McDonough. There's a man called Father Pat.
Jesus, right? You know a lot of people. There's a lot of names coming in here.
If you Google a man called Father Pat, right? He's a very famous priest who lives in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
Right.
And there was a documentary made with him about No Raid in RTE there recently. Through John McDonough and Malky McCourt, Father Pat offered me a place to stay in the Lower East Side. And this priest, who I just thought it was a priest, was a fascinating guy who actually served in prison for 4 years because he was involved in the Brinks robbery back in the day. And Father Pat gave me a place to stay in New York so I could always have a place to come back to while I was building.
I always find that, really interesting. Like people who couch surf, isn't that what they call it? So like, you're going into this guy's house. Are you not getting the heebie-jeebies going, listen, I don't know this guy and I don't know what his hygiene is like.
I have been in situations where I thought, like in Father Pat's house, he has this cage when you walk through the door and cameras. And then, would you believe...
Hang on, whoa, a cage and cameras?
But...
What's the cage for? Did you not get freaked when you saw this cage?
I didn't know about Father Pat and what he'd done in his past life. We just love history and his father fought the 1916 Rising and I had no idea, but there was a great moment where he was telling me about his relationship with Daniel Day-Lewis because of the name of the father, or who the name of the father was about. And he said, do you know who stayed in this room where you stayed? And he showed me a picture. So I was kind of like, this is incredible. So I met people like Father Pat and people like Mick Lanfey and the team and Bell Booked. And then as you go, Americans are very opening. They're like, we like what you do. This is our house. They know you're an artist. So they're there with you on the ride. And I felt like I got myself into some scary situations that I wouldn't like.
I was about to say, give me a crazy story that happened to you in America that you don't often tell.
Two crazy stories. One is just the simple one of going into a dive bar. And it was like an exit door and I opened up and it was all bikers and I sat there and I thought, okay, I'm probably going to get murdered here.
Yep.
And out of principle, I bought two drinks just to say, you know, I'm not going. But
you can't turn away straight away. You got to sit
there. That moment.
I've been in those situations. Yeah,
I felt like they were like, the bartender was like, you better go because they're going to kill you. And I was like, okay. So that was, I escaped that and I went to the bar across the road called Eurustic. That saved me. But we're in Florida, in West Palm Beach. And we were at a bar, going back to an after party. A lot of polo players at that time, and gamblers, heavily gamblers, golfing and gambling and poker players and sports and the tracks. Sitting there in the jacuzzi with this incredible woman. And all of a sudden, this guy comes into the party with a gun, starts calling her name, saying it's his wife. And she just calmly says, ex-wife. And then he focuses us in the jacuzzi and he pulls out a gun. The gun is now pointed at me. And he's like, get out of the jacuzzi in so many nice words. And I was just to realize that was a loaded gun. That is his ex-wife. And I just went, you know what? If you're going to pull it, mate. And then all of a sudden...
That sounds like really ballsy.
But I said,
not jumping up and I have visions of you running naked through these rich people's houses.
Two options. Out of there. But my cousin, being an American and he was a driver, he would carry two guns and him, handcuffs. Like, you've got to see where we were. And he came behind him, you know, pistol whipped him, handcuffed him, then called the police.
He actually did that.
Oh, my cousin.
William Ansel had the gun in his hand.
Behind him, pistol whipped him.
Jesus.
Prank always had a gun in his lower pocket. Sorry, and he always kept a gun here and a gun in the car because he was a driver and security. But it was that moment of, it was when I was being interviewed by the police, and it was that moment of, you were struck by lightning in America. Someone's now pulled a gun on you in jacuzzi in Florida. I think if you're into your woo-woo, David, your love and your light, I think America's saying, maybe it's time that you leave.
But I think any entertainers who have spent any amount of time in the States, like, these stories, they sound outlandish, but they're actually quite common. So I remember there's one time I was leaving my apartment in LA. I spent a lot of time in LA over the years, and I was leaving my apartment at the time. I was just going to the gym. It was the middle of the day. It was probably 2 o'clock in the day. I was driving out of the underground car park that was underneath the apartments that we were in. And I check up and down the road and I pull out a bit. As I pull out, I can see there's a guy coming down the wrong side of the road, right? And I'm out now and he's going to hit me. Yeah. And all I can do is just pull the brakes, right? So I pull the brakes. And as he went past, and this is like, I was in my 20s at the time, so I've come back a long time now. As he went past, just spontaneously, my middle finger went up to him, right? And as my middle finger went up, I saw what he looked like. And I was telling my middle finger to go back down, but it kept going back up. So I knew he was from gangland territory. So anyway, I couldn't get my finger back down. And then I just turned right to go to the gym. And the next minute I heard the screeching of tires. I was like, oh, no. And the next minute I'm driving down and he's reversing down the street after me. And I knew he was coming after me. So I just kept going. I went down to what's called Robertson Boulevard. I turned right. And I got caught at the traffic lights, stuck in traffic. And he just pulls up next to me and he just pulls down his passenger window. And he's just like, he had a gun in his hand. He's like, I'll pop you right now, motherfucker. I'll pop you right now. You break me off like that, you little bitch. And I was just like, I'm so sorry.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry. Please don't shoot me. Like, I was just like, I just wanted him to know I didn't have a gun. I was just like, but I pulled in like 3 minutes later and I was just shaking out. Like, I was literally just wobbly jelly. Because, you know,
we the Irish, right, we're outspoken, we'll deal with conflict. But there's that moment where you were sitting there saying, I'm so sorry, because people get killed and murdered there every day.
Yeah, but this is it.
And when you're there, you see it. Now, it doesn't, but it happens every day. It's just that if you see it, like with you, that person could have taken your life over a middle finger.
Oh, this is it. Yeah. I'll tell other stories on other podcasts about my times in Los Angeles and the States. But we won't get into those now. So tell us this, a moment that you trusted your gut over logic and maybe when it paid off. Now, like, do you trust your gut over your mind sometimes?
If I hadn't decided to book my tour individually on my own around America, it had changed my life. And I just went with it. If I hadn't decided to do that madness, to book those venues, my life has changed for the positive in my career financially, and the people I've met have changed my life. And if I hadn't have listened, if I hadn't have said, do the crazy, trust your gut and go for it, I wouldn't be in the situation where I am now. So I'm very grateful that since the last couple of years that America has opened its doors to me. And if I hadn't taken that chance, if I didn't go over on that flight in 2022, I wouldn't be where I am right now.
Now, we're going to talk about where people in Ireland can find you in a moment. But before we do that, where are you now with your career? I'm just intrigued. Like, is it still to break the States, or is it like a lot of people do, even myself? You go to America, you do well in America, and now all of a sudden you come home and people embrace you at home and maybe you want to do Ireland again. So where's your focus,
I'll,
I suppose?
Be very, any listener out there, I'm going to be so honest with you right now, because I'm very honest in any interview video or podcast I do. I've been very blessed for my success outside of Ireland, but when I come back here, I feel like it's a closed door for me. I don't feel I get the same opened arms.
And that's sad. Why is that, do you think?
I don't know. So let's say if I didn't blow smoke up certain people's backside.
We can say ours. It's fine.
Yeah, Grant. All
it's
right?
a podcast.
But then there's people who don't like me and don't hire me. And that's okay, because it's a personality base. But if you prove yourself that you can...
What's about you not to like? Like, we all have traits that people don't like.
No, but honestly, I'm not going to say that I am, like, no, if you think I'm an asshole, that's fine. I'm not going to pretend that I'm not everyone's cup of tea, and I get that I could rub people off the wrong way. Yeah. But if I'm delivering out, selling out shows with 5-star reviews, and I'm not getting the opportunity over here, I accept that. But I don't want someone who's finishing college, they've gone out, and they think, if I do it the right way, if I email the right people, put on plays, take a financial risk, take a showcase, invite these soap pop people who can change your career, come to see my show, they won't go see your show.
Right.
It is, you've got to understand that it's not you personally, it's just the business. Yeah. You haven't been selected. Don't let bitterness take over your life. Own who you were and where you were. Yeah. So I know I've got a career outside of here, but as Frank Allen said to me, I'm very blessed that I've got a great group of people who come see my shows over here. Don't let that be twisted with your version of your hometown. So I know I can play the Lark, the Abbey. I know I can play beautiful venues in Kerry that people will come and see me and support me because I've grown a loyal audience where what they see is what they get. So I'm in this situation when America's gone great, we're looking at Canada, we're going to go back on tour in the UK, and it's what's the next move for me in my career here. This is where I love to tell stories, I love to connect audiences, and I'd love to grow that. And that's where I am. I'm in this beautiful crossroads, positive crossroads of my career, where I've worked so hard to get here. But what is next? And I'm very grateful for anyone who buys a ticket, because at the end of the day...
I was about to say, so I am going to interrupt you, because I think you need to be open-minded, which is the name of the podcast, by the way, to the Irish audience embracing David Gilner. I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I completely get what you're saying. But I think it's about people listening to podcasts like this going, do you know what? That guy's got a mad story, a great story. I'll go buy a ticket for that. So I think you need to be open-minded to converting people in Ireland. But I get what you're saying.
If you come see my show, what you'll get is you get laughter, you'll get tears, and you get silence. They're my three things.
Lovely.
I like to make people laugh. I like to make people cry. And I like to sit in silence. They're the three things that you... And you will meet me afterwards, because I love to chat, because I'm the numbers I'm playing to is that sale. I've got the time to meet every single person after the show. But the point is,
and
I've got
important.
And I've got most merchandise. I've got merchandise
merch
to sell now.
I've
got my poetry book, you know what I mean?
On your poetry book, tell us where people can get these poetry
books. So it's available on Amazon and most online bookstores throughout the world.
What kind of poetry is it?
It's a mixture of collections, 24. So from grief to laughter, to banter, to waiting room. It's me. It's called 24.
Give us one of them. Can you read one out to us there?
Yeah, of course I can. I was born on the 24th. There's 24 poems, and I'm going to read you 23, which was inspired by one of the lads from my local village, and it's actually in my play, Did I Ever Tell You? A secret base we used to hide from the world outside when we were just two boys from the Jacko. Swinging from homemade swings and climbing trees, itchy back fights and Mr. Freeze. Lost in imagination and free to be wild. A pact was made, blood brothers for life, down by the valley. But a darkness took a hold of you that I didn't see. This dapper man I knew, so full of warmth and banter, was swinging alone between the trees. I miss my blood brother, two pints at the bar and the banter. I cry at night so nobody can see my pain. I scream by the tracks to drain out my anger. But this is not a selfish act of a man of sane mind, but a brother so lost that this was your only answer. The smell of a joint reminds me of you, that cheeky glint, a ladies' man once so full of life. You are free, my brother, free from pain, free from darkness. But why? When I close my eyes, I hear a laughter in the trees. Forever in my mind, two best friends, the boys from the Jacko.
Whew. That's actually an amazing poem. I listened to every word and I think there's a beauty in it. There's a sadness in it. I related to it so much, you know, the Blood Brothers thing. I actually did that when I was probably 7 or 8 with a penknife I probably wasn't supposed to have. My own kids wouldn't even know what that means. But I think what I'm taking from that is just the power of storytelling and your storytelling. So we talked a lot about you being a playwright, but obviously you've written poetry. So talk to me about storytelling and the power of storytelling.
What I realised from acting on stage to writing plays to what direction I was going, and the direction I realised was, why do I tell stories? Why do people come to my shows? And what's the connection? I believe that storytelling is the only thing that lasts, the only thing that matters after we go on to the next life. That this idea of human contact, story to story, that's where I started to go with this. So with that poem, 23, The Boys from the Jacko, everything I write is what's happened in my life. It's what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back from London and I was putting on a play in my local castle. It's a huge honour for me at the time. I was walking down the main street and I bumped into a friend of mine who I went to school with, primary school. And this guy and I had a bond because we had my first physical scrap.
Right, okay.
And he was talking about life in London and I could see there was a sadness in his eyes, but I didn't know what was happening. And he talked about the acting and the writing. We talked about our childhood, Blood Brothers, Mr. Freeze, hanging about. And I was going off to rehearsals above a local pub. And I said, do you want to join me for a pint? He says, is that what you call actors? You
know? Yeah.
And I said, look, he goes, I'm just going to go for a walk down the Jacko. I love it down there. They're quite peaceful. I said, look, we're very blessed that we have these places on our doorstep.
What's the Jacko?
Jacko is like a park. It's a nickname. Okay. So it's a valley there in Swords, just off Main Street. And as I was walking down to go to rehearsals, I shouted back at him. I said, "Who won that fight between me and you when we were kids?" And he laughed back and he says, "Let's call it a draw, Gilna." And I walked off. And then a few days later, I was told he took his own life down by the Jacko. And I sat with that and I gave that man time. And my own community has been hit with a lot of suicides, both men and women. And I wanted to write a poem to connect with people, to say there was nothing that I could have done. I just gave that man time. And I wanted to honor him, his life, and that beautiful connection that I'll always have with him, that my light is still going and his is not. And I wanted to be so careful how I worded it, the respect I had for him. But when I look back and I talk to different people, he was going down there because he already knew what decision he was making. And that was going through his mind as I was walking by to go to work. And I wanted to write that poem and say that poem in every show I go on tour. So if there's someone in that audience thinking about doing something similar that my friend did, that I'll hope they'll sit back and go, "Wait a second, there's people who love me. There's people whose lives will change, that will never go back to where they will be with their family. So please, even in your darkest moments, you are not alone, even if you can't articulate what you need to say or express your emotions. But don't be that person on that page in 23 that's not here."
Oof. I mean, that's heavy, but in a very beautiful way, if you don't mind me saying. And tell me, I'm just intrigued by the process of you just writing that poem. Like, how long does it take you to write a poem like that?
Sometimes it can just hit you. You know, I had this idea, the boys, if you want to talk about the graphic. So I had this idea of a peaceful place where I sit in stillness, I walk and have my coffee. And then when the wind blows in the trees, and then if I was to walk and see a body, what would be my immediate reaction? Would I grab? Would I hold? Would I call for help? And that's where that stemmed from, swinging from the trees as children playing, the innocence of youth, how far we could jump. That idea of Peter Pan imagination, feeling free, getting lost in the wind, but no stress, no fear, no abuse, just to roll in the grass. And then to be that man or elderly woman who has got no light and is going back to this place that once was so full of joy to take their own life. It's to be able to find a balance in the dark and in the light with my work, I think, with everything I do. I just couldn't sit and tell jokes throughout 75 minutes. Some people say to me, "Oh, you know, there's a lot of deaths in this." And I said, "But that's life. Life hits you at different directions."
So, is there a lot of deaths in the booklet, 24?
There's a lovely one I wrote that was called The Waiting Room. And my mother was ill for so many years and I just didn't get it until one day I was waiting for my own test results and the penny just dropped and went, "Oh my God, I'm sitting in the waiting room of life. My mother has never let me in to know what her pain has she been in." So I wrote this poem about the waiting room in life, about people when they're sitting outside, that specialist waiting to get those test results, how they've been living with this moment for so long that life moves on, your children, your routine, your job, your work, your promotion, but inside you're fighting this eternal battle. And my godfather always says, if you don't share your illness with people or talk about it, that cancer will eat you up inside. So even if you just tell one person, don't let that sit on inside you. So I wrote another poem about the waiting room, about that journey, I wrote another one about the artist, the way of life. And you know, don't forget the roar of the crowd or that sit in silence, and that you have to feel that creative soul. It's so important. So there's things I'm very passionate about that I want to get out there. And because I believe in what I believe on the pages, and I've been given this gift, where how long it lasts, whether it leave me, is just that I can sit there. I will work on creating a show where I'll take you on a journey of highs and lows, and you get to know me and I get to know you. And it's just beautiful experience of the spoken word. And it's just me and a few people trying to make it work. And in this glorious madness, I've just had this most incredible journey for the last couple of years. And I've realized with this tour, I've got 3 shows left at the end of the year. If I was never to do this again, Keith, I've lived. The laughter and the tears and the moments stay inside me no matter what I do. I was very morbid looking at my last 3 shows. It's only 2025, but That's how I'm feeling right now. So I'm really excited to be on my own in my kitchen, getting ready for this next stage and where I can make the show better, what I'll bring into it. So that's where I am at the moment now.
Yeah. Well, you're clearly a storyteller, but I always say the most powerful stories that we tell are the ones that we tell ourselves on a daily basis. What stories do you tell yourself?
Oh God, you don't give up.
Yeah.
And that's real true, because this industry will take you on the extreme highs and extreme lows, and you sit a lot with yourself. And I just love to create. And I've very blessed anyone who I've got to share that with. Mm. But I've got to sit myself, why do I do it? Why am I out there putting myself there? It's because I love it.
Yeah.
And I take ownership of that. So why do I wake up every morning? Because I love people. I love walking down my main street, talking to the people in Sword Side of Towns or your man across the road. I love people, Key. I love talk. There's this great story. Right, I'm going to name you. You know yourself. I had to ask her, could I tell her this story in the play? Her name is Teresa. She's a dear. She lives down the road from me. Anyway, I'm in the HQ, let's call it the coffee shop. I'm writing away every day. She goes, David, I've got something to tell you, but don't tell anyone. I'm brutal at keeping secrets. Why are you telling me? They found a lump. Her husband's terminally ill anyway, so she doesn't want to tell him. So she tells me, says, pray for me. I was like, oh, Jesus, why are you doing this to me? So I pray for her. She comes back later. She hasn't told her family, hasn't told her grandkids. Anyway, she gets the all clear. They remove the lump. She's free, but she can't smoke anymore. And this woman smoked every day, and she's in her 80s. Well, I'll say you're in your 60s, love. And she says, David, what I do was when the kids aren't looking, I light a cigarette and I go out in my back garden and I just wave it around and dance around it, laughing. Like, and I said, oh, can I tell that story on stage? Yeah. And she goes, yeah, but just don't mention my name. Grant, I go on, mention my name. I've never been in the play before. So I have these little pockets, I call them, of moments of people have told me these beautiful stories, which I love, and of a lady who's lived her life dancing around a cloud of smoke with a lit cigarette out of a back garden. To me is poetic more than any other, you know, sayings or shaman or, you know, organic ritual dipped in our paganism. Is a woman in North County Dublin lighting a cigarette, dancing to the waves of smoke. I absolutely live for that.
But just picking up on it, right? When I say the most powerful stories are the stories you tell yourself, I always say to people this, right? And I haven't said this in this podcast before, but I think it's a good moment first perhaps to finish on. I always say, start by asking yourself, who do you not want to be? Like, that's a really powerful question. Who do you? We all talk about who we want to be, the law of attraction, the law of manifestation, the power of visualization, the power of our creative vision for our future, you know, all this kind of stuff. Who do you not want to be? Like, so I say that to people right there, like, what do you mean? So I know who I don't want to be. And it's just three words: an absent father. Now, I had a very present father. I was lucky. So there's no trauma that I need to be present for my kids. But I'm aware in our industry, and you don't have kids, do you?
No.
Not yet.
I've settled down for the first time. I'm very blessed. And so my mind is on a different wavelength than it's ever been before.
But you'll kind of get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, I've traveled the world. Even last year, I was on flights nearly every week of the year out of Ireland working. But I'm always very mindful of, I don't want to stay an extra day or 2 days abroad when I can get back home, be on the rugby pitch with my son, or get back home and go to the karate tournament or whatever it is. So I'm very clear on who I don't want to be, because in our industry, I know lots of people who've missed that. So they've missed their kids' birthdays. They've missed all of it. So listening out there, if you ask yourself who you don't want to be, some people will find the answer is they're already there. They're already the person they don't want to be. And that's okay, because if you're aware of that, with that awareness comes a responsibility that you can actually move as fast as humanly possible away from that. So have you ever asked yourself that question?
I'll tell you now, you sent goosebumps down my spine when you said not to be an absent father. I have nephews and nieces. I've got an amazing partner in Louise. I see them play their sports. I can't wait for the next chapter in my life. I love being there for my nephews and nieces because they gave me a newfound love that I didn't know was there, because my sister-in-law lost her husband, and my nephews quite tragically had lost their father and their coach. So those words to me hit like a truck, because I know what it's like for people to have an absent father and how different people's in life's roles change. But for me, I don't want to be that boy at the end of the bar who's bitter about the industry. I've most so many of them from all acting, music, composers, directors, producers. I want to be that guy who says, that was the life that I lived. That's the life I chose. And did I have one hell of a time telling the story? drinking a pint or going crying, going, what the hell am I doing? That's the person I want to be. I don't want to be the person to let bitterness and rage take over them life, because this industry can do that to you.
Absolutely.
I want to be that guy who's going, yeah, I've lived it, I've danced with it, I've smoked it, whatever it is, I've done it.
And yeah,
that's where I want to sit with. I don't want to be the person who lets bitterness and rage take over the life as an artist, would be my honest answer.
Beautiful. Well, on that, it is time to wrap it up. Where can people in Ireland find those tickets? Because we have to be open-minded about selling those out. I'm going to be there on one of the dates, so I'll promise you that. So tell us, where can people find you on tour?
You can get it at davidgilna.ie, G-I-L-N-A, or arenalinks.ie. And I'm performing at the Abbey Tavern in Howth on Saturday the 11th of October, Thursday the 16th of October at the Lark Concert Hall. And then we go over to Liverpool on the 22nd of October at the Royal Court. Thank you very much, guys.
And the name of the show is, of course, Did I Ever Tell You? Thank you so much, David Gilna. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Grazie.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow, rate and share wherever you get your podcasts. It helps others find the show and it means the world to us. Thanks for listening.
Go Loud.